Now to introduce our speaker, we are very happy to have one of the most well-known European and also I think from a global perspective most well-known researcher in cognitive science of learning with representations and multiple representations, Sharon Ainsworth from the University of Nottingham. She's currently a professor there at the School of Psychology, but she's also a principal investigator in the Learning Sciences Research Institute, LSRI, which is also a member of Naples at the University of Nottingham there. Her education started with a bachelor's degree from the University of Portsmouth with the dissertation title, A Production System Model of Children's Multiplication Behavior. And she was awarded with a prize for this bachelor thesis already in the early 90s. Then a bit later, the Master of Science in Knowledge-Based Systems from the University of Sussex with the dissertation title Coppers, a Mathematical Microworld for Multiplication. So still in the mathematical area and with technology and media. Then her PhD in the late 90s from the University of Nottingham, designing and evaluating multi-representational learning environments for primary mathematics. So still in the mathematics area, still representations for learning with the supervisor David Wood. Her positions in research started at the University of Nottingham in the psychology area as a research associate, then research fellow in the Center of Research in Development of Instruction and Training, also School of Psychology. And then since 2002, she is a principal investigator, has been a principal investigator at the Learning Sciences Research Institute at the University of Nottingham. Teaching-wise, she started her lecturer career in the late 90s, then became a senior lecturer at the School of Psychology at the University of Nottingham and an associate professor at the School of Psychology, also at the University of Nottingham. I think I will not talk much more about her. If you want to look at her citation indices, so this is quite impressive. She belongs to the most cited people in the area of learning with multiple representation and cognitive science, and has some of her papers are really very frequently cited, even quite young papers are very often cited, and I think we will focus on some of these aspects with the DEFT framework that are currently the most discussed in Sharon's work. So Sharon, we are looking forward to your webinar and are curious about how you might structure this.
Thank you very much, Frank, for that introduction. And by introducing me, I realized once more of the dangers of the web. So you have clearly Googled me and found my old psychology web page, because I've actually been in the School of Education now for the last 15 months. So I really must take that down. Yes. So I left after 20 years in Nottingham Psychology Department. I left for a chair in education in August 2012. So this is changing my work a little, as we might see as we go on. So. Thank you very much for coming, everybody, today. I sort of realized that today that almost everybody here is here in a way that's inconvenient. So if you're in America, I presume you're inconveniently here because it's the day after Thanksgiving and you should all be at home eating turkey and recovering from the food blowout. And if you're in Europe and in Sweden, it's already getting late on a Friday. And if you're at NIE in Singapore, presumably you would really like to have a nice hot cup of cocoa and go to bed already. So thank you very much, everybody, for being here. And I hope that what we can do in the next hour will at least make you not miss that turkey too much. So what I'd like to do is actually minimize the amount of time I spend talking at you and maximize the time we spend working together on some tasks. And so to do that, I have sent round an image file that we're going to refer to multiple times today. So hopefully everybody's got access to that and have either printed it off beforehand, or if you go to the chat session, you should also be able to see the URL in the chat so that you could paste it into a web browser, but I'll tell you when we get to that. Okay, so as Frank indicated, I've now been doing this a long time. Now if Frank puts his hand up, so I guess I have to stop broadcasting and let him in. Okay, so I've been doing this research with representations now for quite a long time. And so when Frank and the gang asked me what kind of paper to submit, well, of course, a lot of the stuff that we have is already under copyright. So I wasn't able to kind of send something that wasn't already under copyright. So what I've done is send a chapter that I've been asked to write this year, which will be in press in Richard Mayer's current new handbook of multimedia learning. And that was perhaps an interesting thing for me to think about when I was thinking about this seminar, because I was, in writing that paper, kind of forced to confront something that I actually first wrote at the end of my PhD thesis in 1996, and to see kind of 17 years later the extent to which I still believe what I wrote 17 years ago. And it's always quite horrible to kind of try and do that. But having done that, I kind of decided that many of the things I said 17 years ago, I would be happy to re-say again 17 years later. I just probably say some more things. So that's really what I want to talk about today. So for me, when I've considered learning with representations for the last 20 years, I've always thought about things like, well, are they engaging? Are they motivating? Do they support memory? And so you kind of end up, if you think about that, kind of often thinking about structural properties. So you might start to think, okay, we should start classifying these representations. We should start saying, okay, is this a 2D representation or is it a 3D representation? Is it static or is it a dynamic animation? Is it a video? Is it picture? Is it text? And one of the things I think, if you read in this area for too long, you kind of find that this is a little bit like toothbrush. It's everybody wants one and everybody's got their own. So there are so many different ways to classify different types of representation, kind of based by their structural properties. But early on, I became interested not so much in their structural properties, if you like, but their functional properties. And while I don't abandon structural ways of talking about representations and structural taxonomies, I like to think about functional properties as well, and I'll say what I mean by that in a second. And the other thing I noticed really early on in my work was that essentially representations are just friendly things. You almost never see a representation by itself. It hangs around in pairs or in groups with other sorts of representations. So you don't just see a piece of text in the textbook, you see a diagram, an equation, a graph, a pie chart, icons for going to the next page. And if you look at the kind of generation of textbooks that are being created now for the tablet generations, clearly we've got huge amounts of dynamic representations and videos and animations all going on simultaneously. So sort of these two thoughts led me really to kind of one of the issues I've taken around representation for the next 20 years, really that a really good unit analysis of representation is not a representation by itself, but representations in combinations. So essentially, I kind of believe in representational chemistry, that it's not enough to understand text or pictures, but actually text and pictures interact when you put them together, and that changes what goes on. I think we all know this from our experience. If I were to ask you to read the Harry Potter novels and then you go and see the Harry Potter film, well, you've got a very different experience. If you've seen the film before reading the books, it's impossible, I think, not to then read the books with the pictures of the characters from the film in your mind. So if you're just kind of trying to analyze the text, the fact that there's a film out there will have influenced your understanding of it. So I decided I was not going to analyze representations in isolation. I was going to analyze them in gangs as my unit of analysis. And I was trying to think about the functions that they were playing as much of or as more as the structures that they had. So the sort of things that people might talk about were things like whether they were decorational, whether they were organizational, whether they were transformational. For example, if you use Levy and Karnan's functional taxonomy of pictures, of the functions of pictures in text. But I became interested, as I've eventually labeled DEFT, Design Functions and Tasks. And I've thought about this now for quite a long time, and one of the things I decided essentially was that combinations of representations seem to me to serve three main functions. The first function they serve is complementary, and if a pair of representations is complementary, to me, you're exploiting the advantages that come from having different representations. So they might be different because they've got different information, or they might be different because they've got complementary computational properties. Just to be concrete, so what I would mean about different information, if I were to say to everybody tonight, hey, let's end this webinar and all meet in a really great pub in Nottingham called the Trip to Jerusalem, well, we might first of all need, let's go to Nottingham, let's go to a nice pub in London. We'd need to have, for example, the London Underground map, which provides information about the London Underground stations. But really, if you actually want to know where the pub is, you're going to have to swap to the A to Z map of London, which has the two geographic information. So of course, the Underground map and the A to Z map have different computational properties, but they also have different information as well. But in terms of computational properties, I think this is the thing that we think about most when we think about representations. I think famously, Larkin and Simon were one of the first to really spell it out in detail. But what I mean by this is information, even if representations contain the same information, although I actually think that almost never happens, but even in theory, if they did, then you could still have computational differences. So we know that graphs exploit perceptual processes, so you can follow the trajectories from them much more easily. You can see patterns and do precise read-off in tables that you can't do from graphs. You can use calculations from equations that you can't do in either the other two forms. And, you know, we can think about this for all sorts of different types of structural representation. So really, the first set of rationales that you can come up with is that representations, multiple representations have advantageous functions when they are complementary. And I think there's a wealth of evidence, actually, if you look to it, and I've tried to mention some of it in the book chapter that you've got, that representations do serve complementary processes, and by putting them together, you can often benefit from the advantages of splitting information or from the different computational properties that you see. And then the second key case of multiple representations you come across is this notion of using a representation to constrain interpretation. And certainly within British English, constraint has an incredibly negative connotation. It's seen as a bad thing. And yet for me, I'm trying to say constrain here. It's actually a good thing. What we want to do is we want to constrain misunderstanding of representation. So we use a familiar understanding to constrain an unfamiliar representation. Or we use a representation with distinct properties to constrain an interpretation of another. My favorite example that I tend to give on this one is the notion of the child trying to understand that the straight line on the velocity time graph means constant motion. They struggle with that. They think it means no motion. That constraining possibility then of having a concrete simulation where you have, say, an ice skater whizzing along the bottom, and you can see the ice skater moving at the same time that the line is horizontal, can help constrain your understanding. So in that case, it's clear that I am needing to understand the relationship between these two representations if I'm going to benefit from their constraining properties. I think there is evidence for this one as well. If you look in the book chapter again, I particularly found stuff on simulations constraining graphs. Some of the other stuff, we think there's evidence for it, but it's not always easy to get. And the third kind of key functional role that I've always referred to as the kind of the holy grail of multiple representation research is the notion that multiple representations, if you can integrate over them, provide you with something that you can't see. from a single representation. They allow you to construct deeper understanding of the domain. I very much like Jim Caput's phrasing of this notion that that you can kind of go beyond the representations. Ah, somebody has a scheduled power management remaining. I really hope that's not us. Is it? And it is us. Excellent. Those were the three key functions that I see for multiple representations. So I think that multiple representations can be very valuable, that we have to make a whole bunch of decisions about them when we're putting them together, and we might want them to serve different functions. And so the first thing I thought we could do is, I hope that many of you can have got access to the circulation of blood through the heart image file. So I picked this one off Wikipedia. I haven't created it myself. I actually didn't spend very long coming up with the selection of this representation. I just decided to go for this multiple representation, which was the first one I found on Wikipedia, which I knew I could distribute as through Creative Commons license. So what I would actually like us to do now, either by ourselves or if you're in a room with other people, is spend 3 or 4 minutes perhaps answering some very specific questions about it. And the specific question is that I'd like you to think about is, why do you think this information is presented in this way? Why did the author make the decision to use these forms of representation? Why did the author decide to use two representations rather than just one? And what might be the benefits of using these two together? So it's why in this way, why are they using two, and what might be the benefits? I can type these into the chat box in a second. I think if you look at these for more than 1 or 2 minutes, you'll also start to notice all the flaws in them. So by all means, write those down, but let's not have a conversation about them yet. Let's save that till later. So I'm just going to stop broadcasting now and ask you to answer those questions. And of course, if anybody's got any questions for me while we do that.
Maybe could you repeat the question? So the one was why this way? So why using two of them? What are the others? And maybe our participants could ask if they are not clear what their task is now.
I am putting them into the chat so that we've got them in front of. So is now a good time? Is there anybody who'd like to say why they think this information was done in this way, or what the author wanted to do, or what might be the benefits of using these two together?
Hello. Well, looking at it immediately, when you look at just the structural picture of the heart itself, it doesn't show the linear nature of the process, which the flow chart can do. And then when coupled with it, when I do a piece-to-piece connection from the top representation to the structural representation, it reinforces the process as well as the structure.
I also wanted to add that there are some inaccuracies in the flowchart up on the top, such as the single.
Right, I'm interrupting you because you're not allowed to talk about that yet. We've got another session coming up. where we will talk about the inaccuracies and the problems in these representations, because there really are quite a lot, and the more you look, the more you see. So I'm just going to try and save that discussion till the next one. So sorry for jumping in on you.
If I can then say something different, I thought that the boxes served as containers or holding areas that were then somewhat represented in the diagram. So the two representations. Sorry, one more thing. I also thought that the colors helped out a lot, so that the blues on the flowchart helped connect to the blues in the diagram, and then the purples, even though it was lungs and rest of the body, was not in the heart, and that the red areas were part of the.
We would agree that those different representations as a complementary function in the way, for example, the title, the text representation, it's very important. Otherwise, people that wouldn't know about this issue wouldn't know what it is represented here.
I think it would be great if just anyone who participates could quickly say something in order for also our speaker to hear where you are or what your current understanding is. It would be great.
Hi. Yeah, I was thinking in complementary to the contrast between process and structure, you could think of contrast between temporal relationships and spatial relationships. So the flowchart gives us a great look at the temporal relationships in the flow of time of where the blood goes, whereas the diagram, of course, gives us a sense spatially of where these things are with respect to each other.
One thing that I was thinking about is the third function that you described earlier, the constructing thing, because when I look at this representation, or these two representations, I almost can visualize that I see the lungs here around the heart, in a sense, because they are also a very important part of this. So, well, these two representations help me to construct a new internal representation of the lungs, I think.
In my opinion, these two representations are just like two scientific models. The models represent its components and the relationship between the components. These two different representations could be represent two levels of concepts, I think. Grade levels or different students may need different representations to learn. And
Hi, I think maybe my understanding is that all the three functions you talked about before are served by this, in terms of as the second from the last speaker said, it enables the students or the learners to create some kind of mental understanding or schematic representation, internal representation of what the blood circulation looks like. That may be the constructing function. And I also see complementarity between the two, because the flow shows the steps of the process aspect of the blood circulation, whereas the diagram shows the heart picture shows the holistic structure in general. So the use of the boxes and the arrows, I think, in my opinion, could serve as constraining, because some kind of activity or the component of the heart is represented by the box, and the flow of the blood from one to the other represented by the arrow. That's my understanding.
Is that everyone, or does anybody else want to say something? Because I don't have the definitive answer for this. I'm not the author of this. I do have my own beliefs about what it is.
Now, Felipe had another observation that the color, we were talking about these levels of abstraction when you're doing these representations instead of using the photograph, and that the universal, I guess there might be some correspondence between the colors that are used and the colors that are used in the flowchart and the colors of the other graphic representation. That it might be possible to read across that.
For me, I think the most interesting thing was this constraining with the flowchart of giving it a linear relationship of first you have the blue that's low oxygenated blood, and then you have high oxygenated blood, arterial venereal blood. Because the whole concept of, and just limiting to one dimension and one linearity, because in the heart there's quite a few things going on, and I think this is a good representation of that constraint, that you just look first at a linear relationship that you can follow quickly, and not this being basically three types of circular environments that are working at the same time. So the top representation of the flowchart I think is very helpful.
So it's, I couldn't really have primed you better. It's like I kind of run around with my magician's assistant and put you all down in different parts of the world. Because what I kind of wanted to say from this is that I think that typically I can sometimes appear in my writing as if I'm making it really simple. This is our constraining case, and this is a complementary case. But actually, I think even in this simple example, for me, there's clearly complementary information, for example. There is just stuff shown in one of the representations that isn't shown in the other. You have absolutely no possibility of finding out from the flow diagram the relative size of the atria to the ventricles, for example. So clearly there's complementary information. I also suspect there are complementary processes as well, from the processes of the flow diagram to the structural diagram. And I think therefore if your pedagogical goal or your learning goal was simply to understand, right, what's the functional way that blood flows through the heart, then you could actually see these versus what's the structural properties of the heart and how blood flows through it. You could actually see these as two complementary representations, and all you'd be aiming to do is swap between the flow chart and the structural chart as the need comes upon you to answer those questions. But actually, one of the things you might be doing, if you didn't fully understand the structural representation, and you couldn't see how the arrows on it are meant to convey blood flow, because clearly it's very difficult. There are, you know, the heart is a double pump. We've even got problems with where you would start representing in a closed system. The fact that if you do start with the deoxygenated blood re-entering the heart, you're starting from two different positions, which I think makes it incredibly difficult. So I think you would also see clearly a very clear case that the flowchart is meant to constrain people's potential misunderstandings of the structural chart. As for the constructing one, I don't get that, but that might be because I don't get it. And these are the things that I always try and point out, that I think you can determine these distinct cases, and distinct cases should probably be designed for in different ways. But also, depending on the learner's goal and prior knowledge, some of these distinct cases may be more visible than others at particular points for particular people. So what the designer's intention is and what the learner comes to understand from it is a two-way street. It's not only what the designer intends that will determine what the functions are of any particular combination of representation. So I guess I'll just stop broadcasting here and see if anybody wants to come comment.
If I make a comment here, in terms of the learners constructing some kind of mental understanding of the process aspect or the structural aspect of the blood circulation in general using the two diagrams, I think that may be a little bit of constructing. In fact, the actual construction is when students themselves create this kind of diagram using different sorts of information, collecting data by themselves, and then they create the diagram. That's the actual construction, maybe. And this one is kind of it helps them to create mental representation. Just a suggestion, I don't know. Thanks.
Yeah, I don't know either. It doesn't construct it for me, but it might construct it for you. Right, I'm going to move on, I think, because otherwise we'll run out of time even. So the next part I'd like to join to is more what a learner needs to be able to understand to succeed with this, these representations and the difficulties that they might present. It does all depend on prior knowledge. I think one of the problems when you go looking into the literature on multiple representations to find out whether, I don't know, simultaneous text and video help you learn more than narration and video and all this kind of thing, is that we tend to discount the amount of learning that learners need to do in order to work with representations successfully. One of my genuine concerns about the literature is we tend to be documenting the learning of representations in multiple representations research rather than learning with representations in representation research. And that is because I think for any particular combination of representations, there's a huge amount to learn. You need to understand the syntax of the representation, so how it encodes and presents information. In the case of the graph, you know, you'd just be trying to think about things like, well, axes, lines, labels. You'd need to understand the operators, so you'd need to know how to find maxima, and you'd need to know how to find minima. And so for any particular, every time you add a new representation to the system, they first of all need to understand their syntax. And of course you also need to understand the semantics, so you need to understand how that representation is contextualized against the information you want to gain from it. It's no good knowing how to find a maxima or how to find a gradient if you're looking at a velocity time graph and you don't know which of those will show you a distance, for example. So you always need to understand the semantics of a representation as well. In many cases, though not all, you might need to be selecting from a set of available representations to choose the ones. So you need to understand how to select them. You might need to understand how to construct them. So how you create a representation, which if we've got time, I'll talk about right at the end. And in particular, and relevant to the discussion we're having now, you need to understand how to relate them. So if there's anything that seems to be hard, particularly hard for learners, I would say, it's whether you can see the relationship between two representations that you're presented with. Because for me, at least, you cannot hope to constrain and you cannot hope to construct unless you can see those relationships. So that really kind of brings me to a second set of questions that I'd like to ask. And they are sort of the ones that I interrupted Edwin with really earlier, so sorry about that. But really, what are the possible misinterpretations that can cause difficulties? And what are the disadvantages of each one and the two together? So I'll also put those into the chat. But rather than now thinking about the benefits and what they're trying to do, we're focusing on what's wrong with each of these ones and what's wrong with them as a pair.
Is that in the first
error? Hopefully everybody would like to have something to say that's not very complimentary about these pair of representations. Perhaps we could all join the queue again.
Yeah, hello. I'm looking at the fact that the color coding might be a bit unclear here. For instance, for the color of the lungs and then the rest of the body, they are the same, but then they don't mean the same thing. And then you also need some text to explain why the color changes. That's what I think.
You want to put our other results?
Yeah, I can add a bit. Concerning the second, the anatomical picture, for example, we were thinking it would be easier if we could add some numbers, for example, to explain the arrows, because now it's kind of confusing. But for example, if you add some numbers, it would be easier, at least for me, for us to understand it.
Hmm.
Any more comments, maybe?
Yeah, I think the thing that's missing on the top representation just by itself is it's not clear. You should have, for example, before the lungs, maybe plus O2, and then at the end of it, close the cycle and say minus O2 when it goes to the rest of the body to give this impression. If just somebody's looking at those two images, it doesn't really correspond. And before, we had the interesting comment of the temporal aspect of it, which I really like, but it's also quite a misleading thing, this temporal aspect, because it's not just that you just pump once through it, but you have a pumping and pulling and a continuous three-way circulation and a closed system going on. And I think that can be a bit misleading if you see the two of these graphs together. I think we've got a bunch more stuff, but I think we should let other people speak as well.
Yeah, I think the last comment about the misleading linearity of the system is problematic. It raises an issue in the diagrams, in that you have these two different diagrams that are designed to convey the circulation of blood, and really what's missing is an idea of the mechanism. And so if you're going to talk about or try to and promote learning about the circulatory system, then I think one of the keys is what is the mechanism? What is the mechanism for the blood flow? And that's not easily represented within these two diagrams.
I want to second this comment, because I think from the functional perspective, we don't know what happens within these different boxes. We just see the flow. So I'm not sure if there is, you know, the represented information is adequate to create good understanding on the part of the student. So we see the flow, but we don't know what happens in these different boxes. So that's one thing. The second one is a correspondence among the different parts, especially the structural component, the heart and the flow, and the use of colors, color coding, the correspondence in the use of colors in the two representations. The same, let's say, pulmonary artery or something is represented differently in the two circumstances. I think that kind of correspondence could help. We see flows in the structural representation, the heart. There are arrows showing that, and there is the top flow diagram. I don't know to what extent the two correspond, or it could be repetition, which may be meaningful to create deeper understanding, or there may be variation between the two. So, and also the link, the transition between the flow diagram and the structural diagram is not really clear. They seem to be independent there.
Yeah, besides being very far from this subject, I mean, when I look at the representation, the first one with the boxes here, the first thing that startled me was that, okay, it seems to be very far away from the aorta to the rest of the body, because that arrow is much longer than the other ones. And that was the first thing I noticed in this representation. And I think that could be misleading in a sense as well, because I got the impression that the heart is separated from the body then, and well, it seems to be pretty far away. Ah.
Yeah, and I've even got some more. So I don't know whether you've noticed, but the valves are missing on the flow back from the lungs in the flow diagram for reasons that don't really make sense. If you think you needed to know about the tricuspid valve and the pulmonary valve and the Y up, why don't you care about the mitral valve and the aortic valve? That kind of seems weird to me. Then I'm kind of worried about the fact that the pulmonary veins are just missing on the flow diagram. So if you want to have these two things to help you understand one another, to kind of miss out key stages seems completely loopy. I think that somebody at some point has recolored the structural diagram where they have accidentally started to miscue the meaning of the colors. So it's clear that the person on the top intends to use the classic oxygenated and deoxygenated labels, although wouldn't it be nice if they'd chosen to give us those labels? But then we've got the lungs being purple, which is always crazy for me. I really wish they wouldn't do that. And then I think the bottom structural diagram, the fact that they seem to be representing the aorta in red makes me think that they were trying to use those color conventions in that, but then they didn't carry it through consistently because of the left ventricle and the left atria. Other things I noticed were the fact that you get these two pulmonary arteries going nowhere. I wish the lungs were here, even if they were shadowed out. And then coming back from the lungs, we have the very specific information that there are two pulmonary veins that leave the lungs and enter the heart. Now, I'm not a biologist, but one of the things I know is that in normal human beings, there are between 3 and 5 pulmonary veins that typically re-enter the heart. So the very choice of using two, to me, kind of makes me almost develop the misconception that there are 2 pulmonary veins per artery, per lung here. I guess Diane, who is a biologist, if her sound was only working, could tell us whether I'm right or wrong about that. I kind of worry on the structural diagram whether we need all the complicated Latin language. Is that really what we're trying to convey here? Again, there's no labeling. And the mismatch between the use of colors and the misuse between the stages, between the two, I think is phenomenally unhelpful. So sorry, one thing I meant to say was all representations are partial. So I think it's very difficult in this representation to understand the mechanisms. I think it's impossible in this representation to kind of get the sense of the simultaneous pumping that goes on in the heart. What I would say is that I've probably been a little bit unfair, though, because I've extracted this from its general Wikipedia context, where other information is provided about other parts of this. So it's probably not as bad as we're making it seem, because I've decontextualized it. I suppose, for me, what I constantly come back to in these kind of situations, and we had a discussion here in the room as well, it's only if you understand circulation of blood through the heart that you can probably understand this representation in the first place. If you were actually trying to learn about blood flow through the heart and learn the representation simultaneously, but I suspect most of us have used our understanding of this in order to understand the representation, which is clearly not what the author intends. Frank, I'm going to ask you to butt in a second and tell us how long we've got left.
I think we have about 20 minutes left, 20 or 25 minutes. So if we come to our last activity and then also open the floor to more general questions maybe of the participants then.
Okay, so I think one of the things we could see from that and the way that the discussion was going is all the ways we could hopefully improve those representations. We could redesign them to be more consistent. We could add labels. We could think carefully about making sure that the information we're using across both is genuinely common. We could use consistent and canonical approaches. We could explain that they're partial and put them in a wider context. We could discuss perhaps the problems of representing a closed linear system in the way that it's been done. So I think we could almost certainly do it better. And maybe one nice bit of Naples homework is somebody might want to go and do it better and upload a new image to Wikipedia to make this slightly better. Ideally, somebody who also understands the biology, but that isn't me. So I'm going to skip a discussion around how we could redesign this and just know now that we could all do this better. and kind of end perhaps on 15 minutes on what I think about the future of multiple representations. So what might that be? Well, for me as a researcher, one of my things about the future of multiple representations is kind of putting our understanding of the cognitive aspects of multiple representations into context with the other parts of representations. So there's almost nothing that's really very well done, I think, on engagement, motivation, and effect in multiple representations. There's interesting and developing worlds on sort of things like strategies and metacognition, really interesting gesturing and haptics, we're seeing kind of some interesting motor components. So I think one of the future for me is understanding the future factors that aren't so cognitive. So like I say, I still don't kind of disagree with what I've written, but it's not sufficient for me anymore. I'm much less purely cognitive than I was 2 decades ago. I'd be thinking for the future of our work, thinking about process and outcome measures here. So there is some interesting work, obviously, around eye movements. Potentially, we'll be seeing interesting stuff around verbal protocols and data mining. And I think if I'm saying outcome, then one of the things I'm talking about is my commitment to thinking about, well, what do we want people to learn when they're learning with representations? And for me, at least, that's representational competence. So one of the outcomes for me of any learning experience, particularly in science, which I now spend more time in than maths, is that a learner should be able to understand the representational tools and practices of their field as one of the outcomes, as well as one of the inputs. I'm really concerned with what teachers can do. A book chapter I've just written, I read all journal publications published in the last 3 years on the use of visual representation in science education, and found that only 8% of them concerned what the teacher was doing with representations. 92% took the view that we didn't need to know about how teachers mediate their use of representations for learners, and treated them as if it's just enough to analyze the representations in the book or on the computer. And then I'm really interested in the new opportunities that we see. I'm interested in haptics and augmented realities. And I'm really interested, as some of you might know, on educational games, which I think of as a very interesting representational system. But the last thing that I think is both partly the future of multiple representations, but also partly the past, and somebody's already referred to this, is my interest and some of our interest in learners constructing their own representations, so their own multiple representations. So we either give them one representation and ask them to construct one for themselves, or we ask them to invent or select, create new representations. So for perhaps only 3 or 4 minutes now, I'm going to give you a sentence, and I'm going to ask you to try and construct, ideally with pen and paper if you have it with you, but otherwise in your head, a visual representation for this sentence. And I'll both say it, and I'll type it into the chat as well. So the sentence I'd like you to draw is, human life depends on the distribution of oxygen, hormone, and nutrients to the cells in all the parts of the body. And when we come back from that, we'll talk about why that might be a really effective thing to do with multiple representations. I guess while I continue to talk, you guys continue to draw, feel free to, you know, take a photograph of these and email me them. It'll be interesting to see what you've done. I have probably 500 or 600 drawings of this sentence already in my office. And I know that Diane in Berkeley is hoping to collect some more drawings of this sentence over the next, yeah, or show it to the webcam. If anybody's brave enough, show it to the webcam. But I don't think we'll see them well resolved enough. Does anybody want to try? If so, well, I'm going to wait for...
Hi. Well, I started off with one that showed things at the cellular level and blood flow going around the cell. And as a disclaimer, I am not a biologist. And then I thought that it would be interesting to think about, from a larger perspective on the top, blood flow going in and out of tissue. And I thought of a third diagram, but I couldn't go think of how to depict it, but some kind of a of an idea of a feedback loop between glands, hormones, cells in the body. So I don't know where that goes, but it's just a start.
Okay, now we're on.
I guess
yeah.
So.
So we had multiple representations.
We see guys.
Wait, I...
So this is a basically scaling in with a loop that you have. The body consists of basically cells, and around the cells you have specific fluid. And this fluid is, for example, composed of, what did we say, neurotransmitters, hormones, oxygenated blood, and nutrients. And then have next to that a basically functional representation similar to what we had before, but in this case we keep zooming in, or zooming out in this case. And there we show humans, organs, cells, and basically the connective fluid.
Yeah,
so. As a sort of a general, and I think we had several other representations of functionality.
Yeah, one of those,
the tree one I think was cute too.
Yeah. The tree one is better.
That's rather cute. We also had the idea of, initially I thought of a metaphor to represent the relationship between these three things to a similar process. So for a tree to live, it would need soil, it would need nutrients, it would need oxygen, and it would need the sun. So by mapping these three concepts onto a living organism, it would allow a learner, or it would allow me at least, to map that statement onto something that I knew, while having all the components in a fairly simple model. Is that it?
Mm-hmm. Want to show the last one?
Yeah, sure, why not? Actually, I like that one. It's
well, this one looks similar to yours, actually. I like it,
but
drawn in a different
way. This is quite similar, but what I really like about this is sort of a bit that these things happen in the body, and this was presented, but also zooming in that you see sort of the cells and the fluid, and that there's basically a really complex interaction and flow continuously going on. I think this is actually also a nice representation of some of this. A nicer drama than yours.
Very nice. I still want them if you're prepared to share them, but don't feel that you have to. So Frank asked me a question. He says, can this be linked to the DEF framework? And for me, it really can. And it's back to, I think it was the argument from somebody earlier. I forget your name, sorry. So what is drawing doing here? And I think drawing here is a phenomenally constructive process at this point. So I sort of tried to say that I think what happens here is drawing requires learners to make their explicit their understanding. And that helps them overcome gaps in their knowledge or generate new inferences or overcome gaps in the material that they're presented with. And if that sounds familiar to you, well, that wouldn't be a surprise because that's a paraphrase of the self-explanation effect. But unlike the self-explanation effect, which leaves you with a transient verbal representation to perform this constructive process on, when you draw, well, you can bootstrap further effective strategies. So diagrams have all those computational properties we discussed earlier around the cognitive and perceptual computational properties. And as a result, I think, and there's a little bit of evidence to support this, that diagrams can therefore be, can bootstrap other effective learning strategies. So I found that drawings are much more, that diagrams prompt self-explanations much more than text does, for example. So yeah, Frank, for me, when you draw a representation on the basis of another one, it seems to be very close to constructing deeper understanding across multiple representations, and might be the way that I have most consistently come in my career to pursuing the holy grail of constructing deeper understanding through the use of multiple representations. So I'm going to finish in a minute. I know Frank might want to ask me a question or not, or you might want to ask me some questions. I just want to sort of say that if you're interested in this area, if you're going to do dissertations in this area, I think it's a really brilliant area to do research in. Because I've been researching the issues of representation supporting learning for the whole 22 years of my professional career. And I've never got bored, because the representations I'm researching have changed over that 22 years. So I can sort of build on my knowledge but change it all the time. So at the beginning I was looking at coin calculators on, you know, kind of using iconic pictures to help support children's mathematics. But now I'm looking at, well, with a Dimitrios, a student of mine in this room, we're looking at people drawing in dissection classes, in medical education. I'm looking at educational games and the design of those with another one of my students. I look at things like avatar design and haptics. I'm talking about representations to learn dentistry at the moment. So it's a fantastic area, because it kind of, you never run out of things to research. And the issues that you research therefore change as well. So I started off, as everybody would have started off, back in the sort of the 80s when I was starting to do this very cognitively, but now I can sort of remain interested in representation but think about affects and motivation and social processes, and particularly now I have a post in a School of Education thinking about what teachers can do to support learners from working with representation. So I'd say get into this one. There's a huge area that still needs research, and there's lots of interesting things to research.
Okay, thanks. Well, thanks, Sharon. My question now would be, there will be a couple of minutes, or there would be a couple of minutes now for other questions of the participants. So maybe you had, you were surprised by some areas of the text that, or you would like to make some other comments related to the text or our discussion, there would be room for this now. Just join the queue. I will start with the first question, if I may. So even if you said, Sharon, that you moved a little bit beyond just pure cognitive analysis of how representations, multiple representations work, one aspect that is currently focused again in also cognitively oriented research on learning is failure-driven learning, if you wish. So erroneous examples, productive failure. And I wondered, parts of your, in the paper, parts of what you, what your line of argumentation is representations can simplify the required cognitive processing to some extent for participants to understand more easily about the things about the content. And my question is that always the right way? This is a rhetorical question, but maybe you answer that anyway. So is it always the best way to make the representation 100% correct and also 100% or optimally easy to understand, or is there some value also in making things a bit more complicated and put some errors or some omissions into diagrams to maybe stimulate also some explanation, self-explanation effects?
That's a good vibe of question, isn't it? For those of you who have oral exams in your PhD programs. So yes, Frank, actually I have thought about this. So one of the reasons I am interested in multiple representations is I fundamentally think that it's not a good idea to try and seek the single perfect representation. I think that all representations are partial, that they only can represent part of a complex phenomena at one time. And by doing them, you make commitments, particularly visual representations, you make epistemological commitments to that which you're going to show. So one of the reasons to use multiple representations is to kind of show the partial and fragmented knowledge that any that one representation shows. So what you want to do is encourage learners to abstract over multiple representations so you start to understand what's the property of the representation and what's the property of the thing that you are trying to represent. I worry about making representations too difficult. I would prefer to make representations optimally complex and then support processing over the top of them. So yeah, representations, particularly pictorial representations, can get associated with illusions of understanding. And I think that flow diagram we looked at today could be an example of a representation that could lead to an illusion of understanding. It simplifies the process. Don't you talk principles at me, man. You know I'm the no principles yet principle person. But yeah, now you distract me because I'm telling you off. And then, okay, I'm going to stop that line of thought. And I think the other thing that really interests me about drawing is that drawing kind of encourages the fragmented, not necessarily fully understood states of knowledge to be put down there. So yeah, if I think about sort of failing to learn, or perhaps something that I see is quite similar as Dan Schwartz and John Bransford's inventing to prepare for future learning, in that, in both those traditions, what you're trying to do there is to get some early commitments out of people, to put them down and then reflect on them. So I think that's very consistent with how I think multiple representations should be used. But I'm not sure I'd have passed my viva on that answer to that question.
Okay, if there are no other questions, I have many more, but we also have a couple of questions that we ask many or all of our speakers if time allows. So one is the relation of work on learning with multiple representations or representations in general to learning sciences. So this is also because the Naples series somehow, well, could be seen in a way that there is a discussion around what learning sciences really is. So, and the question is, what is the contribution of learning with multiple representation and research on it to the learning sciences? Quite abstract and general question, but maybe. So I'm looking forward to your answer, Sharon.
So the relationship between representations work and the learning sciences. Well, I really like the fact that there is a strong relationship, I think, between the learning sciences and representational work, because I think it has a distinct flavour within the learning sciences. So I think that the issue of the design of representation and effective representations has been a focus of a large number of disciplines, psychology, cognitive science, educational psychology. But if I were to take a kind of typical Journal of Educational Psychology, so therefore educational psychology approach to this, I think it tends to be short-term experiments in the lab with students who perhaps don't need to know what they're learning, and have a kind of focus on very simple cognitive explanations. And I think what the learning sciences does is say that cognitive explanations are part of that story. But in the other readings I gave, one of which was by Bob Cosmer, which refers to his Journal of the Learning Sciences paper quite a bit, I think what's distinct about the learning sciences approach to representations is, first of all, it's quite broad. So it brings in psychology, but it also brings in computational disciplines, philosophy, for example, as well. And it brings in, I think, more clearly than, say, parts of educational psychology, the issues around professional practice with representations. So we take more seriously, I think, in the learning sciences, I'm going to get shot by some educational psychologists now, but I think we take more seriously in the learning sciences the notions, the fundamental relationship between the domain and what the representation is representing, and how in the long term we would like people working with representations to become professional practitioners with those representations. So that's for me what I see that the key link, I guess.
Urban, would you like to put in your question into video?
Yeah, thank you. My question was that, okay, there's no question about that multiple representations afford learning. That is without no doubt, of course. But I was wondering if there is any research done on describing how this, or how students discern things from those representations. I mean, could there be an anatomy of disciplinary discernment, so to speak, of what those representations afford? That is my question in principle. If you use visual representations, is it possible to make some kind of description of the development, for instance, of how these representations are being seen by students, and how this could develop if they become more knowledgeable in the discipline, for instance? Well, I don't know if it makes sense, but yeah.
I think it makes sense a lot. I'm not sure my answer is going to really hone in on it, but I think it's what I was talking about earlier about the need for both process and outcome studies in this area. So one of my regrets is that I have never found time to write up some microgenetic studies that I did of learners working for 8 hours with a multi-representational simulation. So I think we do need process studies of what learners can understand from the representations. And ideally, these are linked to outcome for me. So, you know, I would look at, say, the work of people like White and P in Journal of the Learning Sciences last year is very interesting in this area. Mike Stife, Mary Hecate and others, no, that's not that one. Mike Stife and others' papers in cognition and instruction, where they're relating verbal protocol analysis with eye movement analysis. So I think there are studies that are trying to look at this discernment process, because I think, as we've said earlier on, it so fundamentally depends on the prior knowledge that learners have, then it's not a good idea to try and analyze this in isolation. Yeah, Cognition Instruction, the journal. So I like the idea of that. I guess in Sweden, I would say that the John Airey lab is particularly good at this kind of research, particularly relating it to the disciplinary practices, and it's for me a nice example of a combination of semiotic and cognitive accounts.
Well, thank you, Sharon, for that answer. Of course, it's one of my research areas, and I'm very interested in that. And John Airey is actually one of my supervisors, together with Cedric Linder, which you may know about. I think this is very interesting to actually be able to see, especially from simulations, what do students discern here from those representations that could be presented in a simulation, preferably a 3D simulation if you have that. Because I think that is a very strong thing to use in the teaching and learning of different subjects, especially in science, and maybe even more specifically in astronomy, because it's such a special subject to actually teach in, because everything is so incredibly big. So simulations would offer something that would be difficult for other types of representations or semiotic resources, actually. So that is why I made this question. Thanks for your answer.
Thanks, Urban. Thanks for the answers. We are close to the end, time's up of this webinar. So my suggestion would be to have a quick round where every participant quickly says what was maybe the most surprising or the most interesting thing in this webinar, and then well, and include a bye-bye, and then I will say a couple of words, and then maybe Sharon has the last word in that round. Need a script, so if LMU would start, then Edwin, Urban, Engida and Diane, then Juan, Anat, Rial and Pamir.
I'll start, Heinrich. I think it was very, from the ones that I've seen so far, it was the best practical use, and I very much liked sort of the evolution of the representation and the social interaction that you had of correcting errors and reflecting on what the other person, how they saw it and the aspects that they had. This was very well done. As Frank Fisher said, with the errors and the social aspect of representations in a team, that was very nicely done. It was very interactive and engaging. So thank you very much. Bye-bye. Anybody else want to say anything?
Thank you very much for the nice webinar.
I looked at what teachers were doing, and that 92% did not. And that's interesting to me because I'm interested how to help teachers carry out this better understanding of multiple representations. But I'm new to this area, so now I have plenty to read, and I'm...
Yeah, thank you, Sharon, for this interesting seminar. I really liked it, and I just came across your research a couple of months ago, and I really appreciate it, and I look forward to dig into it and see what it can help me with. So thanks again.
I think this was a very informative and insightful session. I work in the area of meta-representational competence more from the perspective of students constructing these kinds of representations. We see a couple of issues related to choice of representational tools, when to use what kind of representations, determining representational adequacy. That's where I came to learn about your work, your 1999-2008 publications. I'm familiar with your work, and it's very good to get it firsthand through direct interaction like this. Thank you. It was very insightful.
Yes, thank you very much for a very nice discussion and presentation. We've been talking about your DEFT, the DEFT article in our researcher group about a couple of weeks ago, so it was good timing for us. We find this work interesting in terms of, from a learning sciences perspective, to both include interactions in the institutional context and other kinds of resources in a specific setting, and at the same time, not to black box what these actual representations and aspects of the technologies, for example, that students are using, to have a vocabulary and a framework and to draw attention to these the representations as well as their use. So that's very the contribution of this work for our own research. Thank you for a good webinar, our first webinar, so we hope to see you again.
Okay, if someone else would like to say something, just join the queue. I would like to thank Sharon very much, also all you participants. Thank you very much for your thoughtful contributions, for your discussions, reflections. I think what we saw, that was my personal thing here, I think we saw a very good model how to use representations to discuss about multiple representations and the theories, also in our own seminars here locally in face-to-face settings, how you manage to use our prior knowledge or to activate our prior knowledge, and how you manage to somehow tie in the theoretical analysis with a very practical work. And I think for this webinar series, it was a new activity drawing, and I liked that very much myself. It also clearly showed the limits of our current technology, but I think it worked very well. Thank you very much, Sharon.
This is a great webinar, Sharon. Thank you, and thank you to others for your comments. I work in the area of representations and reasoning, and I'm currently working with a group who's looking at the various aspects of validity in an assessment, mathematics assessment. And my particular focus is on trying to understand how teachers can utilize representations that are produced by students live during the course of instruction, and how they have to reason, some of the challenges that they're faced when they have to reason across multiple representations that are generated across several students, and use that information to inform the direction of subsequent instruction. And I think that thinking about these, the children's responses and their thinking as representations, and trying to now maybe perhaps use the depth framework as a way to think about how the types of affordances that are offered by these various representations might be an interesting and perhaps a useful way to start and continue in this research.
Thank you for this seminar. For me, it was a good experience for reflecting about the representation. It's a good option. And thank you, Frank, for inviting me. It's a good opportunity for me for this process. Greetings from Colombia.
Okay. Thanks, everyone. Sharon, final words?
Well, it would be really great to hear more about these projects, especially as they develop. Especially, I have to confess at the moment, the drawing ones, because I love the drawing ones. And one of the things, that I'm so interested in at the moment is how we can take our work from the lab and work with teachers in classrooms to actually make it more than just theoretical knowledge. And so thank you all for your very kind comments. This is the first webinar I've ever attempted to teach myself, so it's been an interesting learning.